Welcome everybody to another episode, and I'm pretty excited by a lot of, well, for our guest, of course, Peter, who is an excellent, probably the go-to person in sales, but also to all of our loyal listeners. I think that now we have crossed the threshold of being the number one podcast for first-time founders. Speaking to other founders, that's our whole deal. We don't have investors on here. And that's why I want.
Are they listening in?
They definitely are.
Oh God!
They definitely are. but you can't hold anything back. You gotta tell the real truth, because that's what the first time founders have. And so I'll introduce like how we know each other. So me and Pete have known each other since it's probably been like 2016.
A long time ago in a galaxy far, far away.
Yeah, when he was advising me on how to sell to upmarket SMBs and enterprise folks for Ship, which turned out that we did not have the right product, unfortunately. But I got
learned a thing.
I got a sneak peek of his book, and I'd love to just like hand it over to you, Pete, for just an intro on yourself and
sure.
your background and what you're doing now with Atrium and all that great stuff.
Yeah, for sure. Hey, folks, my name is Pete Kazanji. I'm one of the founders of Atrium. We make sales performance management software. Kind of more on that in a second as relates to sales things. Probably going to hear the word sales more than once in this conversation, just going to guess. My background, like a lot of founders, my background was in product management and product marketing. When I started my career in technology, before I started my first software company, I was recruiting software company called TalentBin that was acquired in 2014 by Monster Worldwide. And so kind of during that first founder experience at TalentBin was kind of where I went from being a business generalist founder to our first seller, our first sales manager, our first sales leader, et cetera. And it's kind of where, so subsequent to that, you guys have probably heard the phrase like founder led sales or founding sales or founder sales. Oddly enough, those phrases didn't exist before I started kind of talking about it. For a variety of reasons, I think, and I do a bunch of presentations on this. You can just Google it or like look on YouTube or whatever. There's a founder-led sales kind of like maturity presentation. But you know,
and
the notion
and the book.
Yeah, there was a book that I wrote subsequent to selling TalentBin that really just kind of like it was the book that I wish I had. Right, because I was a product manager, product marketer background, and I was like, "Hey, this software stuff—it just sells itself, right?"
Yeah.
No, it doesn't, right? And of course, if you think about where founders come from, they don't really come from the sales department necessarily. They come from engineering or design or maybe consulting or product management or what have you. So they don't necessarily have proximity to like what sales is from a very basic standpoint. And so when I looked for like, I'm a kind of a bookish guy. When I looked for that book, Sales for Dummies. You know,
right.
In 2010, it didn't really exist. There's a lot of sales books for, you know, existing salespeople or sales managers or sales leaders or what have you. But there wasn't really anything that just kind of broke it down for people who like are starting at zero. And so that was the book I ended up writing. It's called Founding Sales. It's very popular. It's available on foundingsales.com in its entirety. So like the actual text of the book is there, because one thing that drives me insane about paper books and also Kindle books is like the how unsearchable they are, and I want people to be able to use the book to search across it, etc. But that's kind of what, you know, my background there. And then subsequent to that, I started the nation's largest sales operations and leadership community. It's called Modern Sales Pros. It's a peer education community for like at this point 35,000 sales leaders and sales operations folks. And then I have a software company that helps organizations measure and manage and improve the performance of their sales staff, and it's called Atrium. So that's me.
So what really, so you mentioned that you didn't get started in sales. Like what really got you to like go all in on that?
Well, I think it was like a lot of founder behavior. You see that something's not working and you go, why isn't this working? WTF, right? And so actually, TalentBin itself was a pivot out of a prior company called honestly.com. It was kind of like a B2C, like Yelp kind of for professionals, or like Glassdoor for professionals. Didn't end up working from a, from a user-generated content standpoint. And so we kind of pivoted to this recruiting concept around aggregating content for recruiters to do passive candidate recruiting, right? So essentially to be able to like look across, essentially what we did was we crawled like GitHub, Stack Overflow, Twitter, Meetup, da 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 da. It's like, I think it was like a couple dozen sites, and then created these composite profiles that then recruiters could search across and then do kind of recruitment marketing automation, like outbound emailing on. And if you think about it, that's like a B2B tool, right? And so our primary competitor at the time was a tool called LinkedIn Recruiter, which is the kind of the corporate recruiter version power tool of LinkedIn, which is like $10,000 per recruiter per year. And people don't just drop $7,000 or $6,000 a year on a piece of software like they're buying a bottle of Gatorade at a bodega, right? And so that was kind of a initial insight. It was like, oh, people don't just like do this on their own. They need to be guided through these things, right? They need to have conversations with folks in order to understand the problems that it solves, and so on and so forth. And so that was kind of the, oh, okay, cool. So who's gonna do that thing? Oh, you're gonna do that thing because you're the person who understands the problem space and the existing solution, the unsatisfactory solution set that's in the world, and how your technology works in order to, that's better than this solution set in order to solve this problem. Got it. So you have all that context, and then you, so you are best positioned in order to explain that to somebody who's going to give you $5,000 a seat, or $25,000, or $50,000, and so on and so forth. And so it was kind of like one of those things, like, oh, okay, this isn't working. Why is it not working? What could we maybe do to make it work better? Oh, well, maybe we could talk with people. Okay, cool. They have, they have hesitations. Well, maybe we need to have responses to those hesitations, and kind of pictures and slides and videos and marketing collateral, and so on and so forth. So it was an iterative process, and that's kind of why I wrote the book, was to say, hey, you know what? You could probably derive all, a lot of this stuff from zero because you're probably a pretty clever founder type person. But I got an idea. Why don't you spend a weekend reading this book to kind of like speed run that? Now you're still going to have to do a bunch of derivation on your own, but at least you'll have a prepared mind.
Now, I know that you were an advisor of mine. And I just wanted to we like to kind of explain the founder journey on this podcast. And how many other founders did you advise in the sales process? And then before you wrote your book, and then before you actually started Atrium.
Yeah, so I actually, so the funny thing about that is that I didn't do a lot. I still don't do a ton of like one-on-one sales coaching because it's not really super scalable. And have a I have a day job doing
Oh,
a
you do?
weird
Me too.
and weird an all-consuming an all-consuming startup, which even the second time around, I think as Kevin will attest, it is still all consuming the second time around and the third time around and so on and so forth. So like don't fool yourself into thinking it's going to be like downhill sledding the second time, because it's not going to be. But I think the upshot there is that I I'm a big systems guy, a big documentation guy. Like, software is scalable, and words and text is scalable, and images is scalable, and models are scalable. And so the that's where founding sales kind of came from.
Right.
is that you would have a bunch of
the book,
you know, investors or whatever who'd be like, hey, you should talk with Pete around, like you're hiring some account executives. Yeah, you should talk with Pete about, you know, sales hiring, right? Oh, you need to get your outbound going. Oh, you should talk with Pete about like outbound prospecting. Oh, you know, you have customer success issues. You should talk with Pete. And so what ended up happening was I just started kind of like writing documentation on these things, like, hey, here's sales hiring, right? Here's what the interview process should look like. Here's what the onboarding process should look like, et cetera, et cetera. Oh, well, here, let's talk about outbound. Here's a, you know, here's an article on prospecting, how to identify the set of accounts or organizations who should give a shit about your solution. And essentially it was kind of like piecewise. And it's like, you know what? We should just do a curriculum and just like do this whole thing.
But also going back to my initial question, like from like, cause I read a draft of your book and that was in 2016. And like, you didn't publish it until what year?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the physical book, I don't think we got done. And then the Squarespace site until like 2019 or so. But yeah, for the longest time, like it was a book and it was done and it just happened to be like a Google Doc that happened to be inter-hyperlinked.
Yeah.
with you know, a dozen chapters and so on and so forth. And it was so funny because like every time you'd pop into that Google Doc, there'd be like, you know, 50 anonymous emus and so on and so forth at the top in the Google Doc of like people, you know, reading it and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of like software-y in that regard, insofar as it was constantly being updated, like, oh, a new tool would come out, we'd update, you know, we'd update the repo, if you will. And the next time somebody would came across that section of the of the book, they would have that new information.
Yeah, what I'm trying to really like drill into people who are looking to like have a venture scale company is like it takes a long time. Like as you mentioned, like you sold your last company in a long time ago, and then you started writing this book, then you started doing like people would ask you for your advice, like me, and you advise them, and then you get revisions on this book, and then it eventually turned into Atrium, which I don't know if you want to give like kind of a spiel on like how much you guys have raised and like what it actually does for people. But like the journey is like very, very long.
Yeah, I think that's a great observation, Kevin. And I think that like, yeah, emphasizing that to first time founders so they don't feel, because you get like awful survivorship bias in the press, right? Where like,
totally.
Like the people who are being talked about in, I don't know, TechCrunch or whoever's the main character of the day on Twitter or whatever, like that's like selection bias, right? Like, of course they're going to be in your face because, you know, because they raised that amount of money or they got bought or what have you. And what you don't see is you don't see the non-covered things. And my buddy Letty Rachitsky,
I love Letty.
He's phenomenal. What a treasure that dude is. So he has this really great article.
Yeah.
Where he did essentially this like B2B startup like research project that then he then pieced out into a bunch of different pieces of content, but one of which was like how long it takes to get a product market fit, and had a really good visualization on it where it was like company formation, first product, first customer, and then like feels of like first feeling of product market fit. Because what you saw was like, you know, Figma was founded here and it was like 5 years before they had a product. Right. And then and then the funny thing was they didn't feel product market fit until like some time after that. And then like Airtable was like, and so you essentially see these like weird fingerprints of like organizations that like founded, did a lightweight product, launched immediately, got first customers, but then didn't feel like they got product market fit for a while. Right. Which is like, that's a slog right there, I think is a pretty common case. And then there were other organizations where like you found the company, initial product, initial customer, and then feels of like, you know, initial feelings of product market fit. It's like, man, that was like a really key insight, like I don't want to call it lucky, because like maybe it was like a great insight and maybe you're super like observant
it's
or
both.
Empathic.
It's definitely both.
But like, but I can't recommend this article enough, because like you see some of these like survivorship bias companies where you're like, oh, cool. Well, that was the 5 years when they were like lost in the desert, just like, you know, right. hacking. And so it's a very common thing. I think we're like at Atrium, we're a little bit in the middle insofar as like, you know, we founded the company in 2016, raised financing there. You know, the thing with Atrium is, again, like I'm this kind of weird mixture of like left brain and right brain. And yeah. So when I first was doing, you know, sales management and or like founder selling and sales management and so on and so forth at TalentVin, what I kind of recognized, I was like, wait a minute, this is just like, it's like a revenue factory, right? We've got our SDRs and our AEs and our CSMs and things flow along there, and we should probably instrument that. And, oh, okay, it's like, you know, there's 10 parallel assembly lines here. We'll just instrument that using, you know, our CRM and reporting on that, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And then when we got bought by Monster, I hadn't realized at the time, but like that was not very common across most sales organizations, the notion of like measuring and managing by metric down to the individual rep. And so that's what Atrium does. It just makes it super, super, super simple, like, you know, allows you to do that straight out of the box. But then of course now we've layered a bunch of large language model AI across that as well, really to help it help non-metrical, non-analytical practitioners. So like sales managers, sales leaders, et cetera, who are fantastic and, you know, focused on the things that they're good at, which is bias to action and communication and empathy and kind of like reading the room and interpersonal interactions, so on and so forth.
Pete, but, don't tell me that you got on the AI hype train. Please don't tell me. You are a much smarter person than that. Come on now.
We're kind of in the right place at the right time insofar as, well, I think this is actually really instructive as relates to product market fit and kind of like being in the right place at the right time for a shift to happen. So in our case, the big problem that we're solving is taking less metrical, less analytical folks and making it such that they can measure and manage by metric. And so the big challenge there, the big barrier is folks who are not, you know, as we say, like they're not from the math department, right? So if you try to get, if you hand them a wall of dashboards in order to inspect and reason against, they're not going to have success. But you know what's really good about turning metrical insights into human readable words that people can understand?
Yeah.
Large language models. So point is that like that's, and that's something that we've seen quite a bit in the
like
last year.
How, like who is my best performing rep? Like what is the like ACV, like what is my
but more around like actionability stuff. Right, where like as an example, probably a lot of people that are listening to this conversation right now probably are fairly analytical or fairly systems minded. I could hand them a set, like I could hand them a dashboard in which they would derive facts. They would say, oh, that rep right there, like that tile on the dashboard is a bar chart. And that bar right there is lower than everybody else's. That's weird. What is that?
Right.
Oh, that's
right.
The customer facing meetings chart
right.
for these 10
right.
reps. That one is low. Oh, what's the time interval? Trailing 30 days. Interesting. Got it. It seems like Bobby is light on meetings. That's a derivation of a fact by looking at a metric and using like visually interpreting it and then turning that into like human narrative. So now imagine doing that across like 10 tiles, pretty quickly what you're going to have is you're in the realm of like what an analyst is very good at doing, like, you know, interpreting that and reasoning. But what you would rather have is
software.
Something come up to you and say like, Kev, so here's the situation. This rep is doing great along these reasons right here.
Yeah.
You got a problem like Joey. Joey's got a problem. Joey's got an activity problem. He's light on customer facing meetings the last 30 days.
Yeah.
And also his email activity has declined. And you know what? His new opportunity inflow, it seems to have deteriorated in the last 30 days.
Right.
So you should probably go and have a conversation with Joey about it. By the way, we already emailed him to kind of broach the subject.
Right.
That's the sort of thing. Anyway, but the point is that like we were, you know,
I love the whole idea of what you guys are doing, especially because like we're now selling into like mid-market and up to enterprise companies, and I love this. We're still a small sales force, so we're still figuring out that stuff, but we definitely are going to buy and use your product.
Yeah, well, the thing is, so to the point about product market fit and the journey to it, one is like you have to be close to your customer, and the second thing is that sometimes it takes a while and you have to be in the right place at the right time, and sometimes like a key enabling technology shows up, where in our case we were doing all this stuff statistically for a while,
right.
But it's still like it was working really well for like more like analytically minded sales managers and sales leaders, which is like.
Right.
20% of the populace.
Right. Right.
So, but if you turn it into words, right, now all of a sudden you can service a lot larger percentage of the populace. And that was like a key, like we were kind of in the right place at the right time in order to leverage that. Right.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing too is what we found is that the type of organizations that care about this really are much larger sales organizations. So we work with sales organizations that have like 50, 100, 200, 500
right.
sellers versus, you know, a sales organization that has five reps and is just trying to figure out what
yeah,
what's going on.
Yeah, that's us right now.
But yeah, but the point is that this stuff takes a while, as Kev was saying earlier. And the only way that you accelerate things is by having more customer contact and being really close to your customers and listening to what, you know, what's not working about what you're doing and what is working, kind of like looking for those like bright sparks and kind of following those along to, you know, slowly get into product market fit.
So question for you, and you've obviously done this with your previous company, and you've also advised other companies to do this. Like, what do you think? So for a company that is going to sell to, like, well, let's kind of like break out like PLG or SMB for a moment and say like you're selling to mid-market folks. Like, what do you think that they should be starting as founders? They should be doing, like, should they be doing the founder-led sales first, and then should they be hiring like a VP sales and then scaling that up? Like, what is your advice on that? I know that's in the book, and everybody go to the Pete's website. We'll have that in the show notes. But like, what is your like ultimate advice on that?
Yeah. So I actually would do one step even before that, because I have a presentation on this that, that talks about, that does like the words and images version of this. And so if you just Google founder-led sales presentation or Kazanji, you'll kind of see the deck in question. So essentially it's like, it's a stepwise process, right? First step is you want to be doing your customer interviewing, right? So you're trying to figure out.
You as a founder.
Yeah, you as a founder, right? You want to find out whether or not people have the problem you think you want to solve, right? You need to validate that hypothesis. This is kind of what Eric Ries and Steve Blank did a good job of documenting.
Right.
Eric Ries in Lean Startup, and then Steve Blank in Four Steps to the Epiphany, now the Startup Owner's Manual. And so then that's the first thing. Then the next thing is, you know, building the minimally viable or minimally valuable product in order to validate that you are solving that validated problem. If you start building without validating that the problem exists, it's going to be tough because you might build something that people don't want.
It's impossible, to be clear.
Yes, fair.
It's not
fair.
Tough.
Yeah.
You will
but
fail.
if you have validated the problem that you're trying to solve, and then you then fit, you know, magical technology to solve that problem, and then loop back in order to validate that, well, then you might have the beginnings of success there. So that's, again, something a founder should be doing. And then the step after that is you want to validate that people will exchange money for that, right? The first thing is to prove that it actually delivers like utility, even at like low cost. And then the next thing is figuring out how much value is being created, because then it gets traded for money in the form of you know, licensing or usage or what have you. And so again, the founder is the person who should be doing that minimally viable, you know, repetition of kind of commercial transaction.
Do you have like a number, like ARR or anything on that? Like, do you think it's like $1 million in ARR that the founders should be doing that? Is that like just like a
Yeah, usually the rule of thumb that I use there is because this is all about setting what each stage does is it unlocks the next stage. So if you think about what the next stage is going to be after founder selling, it's going to be a couple sellers. And so what you want, and so the worst possible thing you could do is have sellers trying to sell your thing before you have like repeatedly sold it in a statistically significant fashion. So then the question is, okay, like what's statistically significant? And that's why an ARR number is probably not all that terribly helpful. Instead, what you want is repeatability on the sales motion. So usually that's like a dozen or a couple dozen or maybe like a few dozen customers to prove, because the way to kind of think about it is like you're making a recipe, right? A recipe of how to take this thing to market to the promised land. And so then what you have to, like, if you do it once, you can't really like declare victory and say like, great, someone else can be able to do
Yeah,
this
of
too,
course, yeah.
because like it might
Or
have
it's
just been
like your
luck.
friend or like somebody that
Yeah.
your VC recommended or something like that.
Right, exactly. And so that's why what you would want to do is you would want to get to the point where you have like repeatability on that. And so repeatability is going to be different on a per sales motion basis, but generally speaking, it probably looks like a dozen customer, probably looks like a cu couple dozen customers that have closed. And as a result, what that probably means is that means many, many, many dozens of prospects, because let's say you have a 20% win rate or what have you, in order to close, 20 customers, that's 100 at bats,
What is
right?
that actually? What is the typical opportunity to close rate for like a SaaS business?
It's really so like great and would be like 30%, right? Like pretty like maybe not great would be 5 or 10%. Like clearly people are just like not getting it. But there's kind of a circularity to this as well, right? Like it's oftentimes predicated on price. So people might have the need that you address and it's unsolved, but if your pricing is too high, then they're going to say no. Alternatively, you could have a 40% win rate. Usually if you have that high of a win rate, it's probably an indication that you're not asking for enough money. So the way to kind of think about this is what you're trying to do in that founder-led selling motion is you're trying to converge on what the physics of your go-to-market looks like. And so the physics will be described as, how many customer-facing meetings are required in order to close a deal, right? Because that's the fundamental unit of selling is a customer-facing meeting, right? In direct sales. And then you only have like 50 hours in a week. Like, and there's probably only like 4 or 5 hours in the middle of the day where people are going to be taking meetings with you. You can kind of extend that on a, from a time zone standpoint. But the point is that that's your constraint. Your constraint from a factory standpoint or like an assembly line standpoint is how many hours there are and how much. So what you'll figure out, you want to need to figure out how many humans are involved in your sale, who those humans are, what their like responsibilities are in the organization that you're selling to, how many customer-facing meetings it's typically going to take with those various stakeholders in order to close, drive a deal to close, how much they're going to be willing to pay in order to, and then what the competitive set is, or what the need is, crossed with the competitive set, which will give your win rate. And so that's kind of like what you're figuring out during those first 100 at bats that then gets you those 10 customers or 100 customers or excuse me, 10 customers or 20 customers or 30 customers or what have you.
I know obviously a very other prominent sales person on Twitter is Jason Lemkin,
Oh, he's
of
great.
course.
He's got
He's
great
awesome,
content. Yeah.
and he has very strong views on hiring two salespeople at the same time, one to hire like a VP of sales and all that. Do you have any opinions on that?
Yeah, so that's the next stage. And while we were talking, I looked at the blog post in question. So if you just Google Kazanji founder-led sales, that has the entire that has the presentation that I'm referring to. So the stage that Kevin's talking about is the one after where you've gotten to repeatability yourself. And so now what you want to prove is that you can abstract it out, right? That you can abstract that and get someone else who's not you, because if you only have 40 hours in the week or 40, 50 hours in the week, and probably as a founder, probably half of that is being spent, like, I don't know, cleaning toilets and dealing with like staff issues and all sorts of insane thing. All, you know, like
Which
all the.
most first-time founders think that they can just hire somebody else to do all that
No.
stuff.
No, I literally replaced a paper towel roll in the kitchen earlier while like rolling my eyes that someone used the last one and didn't replace it.
I literally did
Yeah, totally. Anyhow, so that will always be your role. But the point is that consumes a lot of time. And so when you're doing those things, which are kind of required, like, oh man, like, you know, so and so got their stuff, like so and so got their laptop stolen because they left it like at a bar. Weird. I guess I get to deal with that today. Well, that's like that. You're the
That's
person who has
you're
to
the
do that, right? You're
founder.
the person who has to do that, right? And so what, but if you can abstract that sales behavior and get a seller or a set of sellers who only focus on that, well, guess what? Now they can spend all of those 40 hours a week or 50 hours a week on that. So that's why it's so important to prove that it can be done repeatedly yourself, because then what we're going to do is we're going to install that software, that sales recipe in their brain and prove that that someone else who's not as product expert and market expert and so on and so forth as Kevin or me or whatever, you know, or the founder can at least sell as effectively as the founder. And so to your question about Lemkin's point about hiring two, yeah, it's great, right? You know, hiring one kind of like you don't know if it's like a them problem or what have you. If you hire two, you know, there's kind of inherent competition there. There's also the fact that, like, you know, maybe one of them is successful. And look at that. That person is successful. And that person, this one's not successful, but I have an existence proof. Like, it's not just because I'm so charismatic and awesome that I was able to sell. It's like, hey, I'm not magic and this guy's not magic either. Okay, this person's a problem right here. If you st so then you might say, okay, well, why not three or why not four, right? And I think the response to
Let's
that
not
is
go
because,
crazy.
yeah, because your job as the founder seller who's who has now derived this recipe and refined it, your job is to get those people to success. And so if you have four people who you're like training and riding along with and babysitting and like, you know, providing feedback to, it's like getting four pots to boil versus getting two pots to boil, right? We want to concentrate our bets there. Now, when we get those two pots to boil, then say, hey, we can do this again. And all while we're doing this,
Another
of course, we're
two
updating
and
our
six and
software. Yeah,
eight.
exactly. And then at that point, now you professionalize the sales management of that, right? But it's a stepwise process, right? And each piece kind of unlocks the next. But if you jump ahead, usually it's going to be a bad time, right? Because you're going to skip some sort of underpinning requirement that then it might work for a while. And I think in the last like 3 or 5 years, a lot of organizations skipped a lot of steps. I think Atrium would probably be guilty of this as well, which is, you know, particularly galling as a second time founder, right? You're like, wait a minute, like you should know better. It's hard, right?
It's
Like,
hard. It's
yeah,
hard. It's
it's
really
hard to,
hard.
yeah, it's hard to resist kind of like taking shortcuts, but I think that that's a really important thing is to not take shortcuts.
So we got 12 minutes left on here, and I'd like to kind of like have like a fun segment of like things that like either that you've experienced, like you've been around in the valley. It looks like you're actually in the East Coast right now with your jacket on.
No, I just our office is I'm here at Second and Mission in San Francisco. Our office is just freezing.
Okay, you should turn the AC off. Okay, anyways, but like, any like fun anecdotes or like anything that you can or any advice that you can like offer the founders that are like looking to start their like journey in this that you could like offer them?
As relates to founder selling or just in general?
Well, no, name names. Like, who is the worst person you've worked with ever in the VC world? I'm just joking. But like,
Was like, is this like the Nathan Latka
no,
podcast or
but like
whatever?
anything like
What's your ARR?
anecdotal.
What's your net revenue retention rate? What's your
Yeah.
GRR?
Anything that you think that could be helpful or like just like kind of like more lightheartedness as far as like starting a company or like the struggles that you've been through as we all have been through. Like my last company, it failed in spectacular fashion and we were supposed to be the next Uber for shipping and we went to zero. And I'm very public about that. Like anything that you could like through your experience in being a venture-backed founder, anything that you could kind of just like share with the people that are listening.
Yeah, I think that a really big thing that has okay, so software companies are people companies.
Yes.
And I think that in the last like 3, 5, 6 years, 7 years, even before it was like a full ZERP environment,
Right.
even before like COVID, we're in a low interest rate environment, is that startups are hard. And so you need high quality humans in order to advance against the problems that you're solving. And startups are not for everyone. So you need high quality humans who want to be in a startup. There can be high quality humans who don't want to be in a startup. And that's totally cool. Like they might be very bright, high IQ, high efficacy, but they probably have lower bias to action or lower resilience than what you want. So what you really want is you want high like level of effort and high, intellectual capacity, high grit. And just like telling yourself a story that, oh, I can fix them, right? I can, this person, like, you're not going to be able to, like, you're really going to struggle with folks that aren't startup folks. That's the first thing. The second thing is that when you find folks who like when you find those people and like when you I guess it's kind of like product market fit. Maybe this is it's like staff market fit or like staff
Yes.
startup fits.
Yeah, no,
When
that's a
you
great
see it,
point.
you're just
Yeah.
like this person is thriving, right? And so when you see that, you really like you should
Give
cherish
them
it.
more. Give them
Yeah,
more.
give
Give
them
them
more
more.
of it. Yeah, give them more responsibility, give them more equity. Right? Like
Salary, like
yeah, just
everything.
like yeah,
Yeah.
because like what you've done is you've kind of you've uncovered a secret usually. And yeah, and like invest in them and you'll identify them because like they're the people who like will do things on their own. Hey boss, I did XYZ. Like they didn't ignore the problem. They didn't, which is obviously the worst possible scenario. They didn't
Right,
see the
right.
problem, but then and then ask about it, which is like okay, but they like saw the problem, proposed the solution, actually implemented a lightweight version of the solution, then came to you after the fact to like validate it,
Right.
right? Like when you find folks like that, it's like oh boy, right? Like wonderful. Double down on them, and then also the like keep track of them. So ideally they stay within your organization, but even if they don't stay within your organization, like they outgrow it or like you're not able to scale with
Or
them
they
or
start another company, which,
whatever,
like,
like whatever it is, but like keep track of those folks because that like and it really all kind of comes down to the initial piece of like finding those folks and like and you know what? Being judgmental about what they look like on the front end, which I think like the notion of being quote unquote judgmental from a quality standpoint, again, over the last like 3 to 6 to 9 years,
Right.
hasn't really been super popular, right? But
No,
I think the
it
problem,
totally is.
I think the reality is that if you are, you know, if you're hoping against hope or too accommodating, it's only going to bite you in the ass. It's going to, like, in 18 months, it's going to suck. And like you forewent, spending lots of time with somebody who is awesome. Meeting people who then, of course, would have brought in more folks. So it's a flywheel effect, and really what you want to do is just, like, don't ignore that, right? Because even if your company is not successful, the thing that will be successful will be that network of human beings, assuming that you did attract high quality folks and work well with them.
Yeah, and that's also why, like, what I do is try to keep in touch with those people and try to like help them out, raise money if they need it, or I do a very small, I actually don't angel invest hardly in any companies, but when I do, just because I'm a one track mind, and I can't actually think about anything except my company, which should be good for all of our investors. But also one of the reasons that like clearly for the people that are listening, the reason that I do this is because I get to spend time with people like you that today I've learned a ton from you. And also, I may have some ass from you later in some other day,
I'll
but
send you
all
hyperlinks from the book. Yeah, that's in this section right here. Yeah, that's in this section right here.
but I think that what people don't really like, first time founders don't realize is it's like you need to make a career out of this. Like this one startup that you're in is not going to be like if you really think about like this is you want to found companies, you want to be an entrepreneur, like the first one most likely is going to fail. Like that's just the statistics on it. And like hopefully your second one doesn't fail as much. And like you're, I think the median age actually I can't remember where I saw this quote was, but the median age for a billion-dollar company is 43. And
About
so yeah, so like it takes it's a long journey to really get there, and it takes a lot of people. So it takes a lot of networking, and it's not the networking in like the bars or
No.
whatever that like
No,
that's just
it's in the
or the conferences. That's
yeah,
just a
it's in
waste of
the
fucking time.
no, it's in the it's in the it's in the trenches and in the foxholes, right? Like that's where the kind of true camaraderie and trust and interaction and like reading the other person's mind and like reacting to their reactions and things like that. That's where that all kind of comes from. And so who do you want in the foxhole with you, right? You want high quality folks. Yeah, and I think that's an example of something that like we didn't do a great job of this time around for a variety of reasons, like, you know, bunch of money coming into organizations, need to hire, right? Maybe you compromise
Pressure.
on talent. You know, the whole COVID thing didn't really help at all. Like, oh, okay, I guess we can hire from wherever, even though like I'm pretty negative on remote organizations in a very like
I
very
am
early
totally
on.
with you.
Yeah, very early
Thank
on,
you.
like once you get to like hundreds and hundreds of folks, right? Like the value.
Certain places in the organization, not everywhere.
Yeah, but I think the problem is that like I think the last like 5 years threw a bunch of curveballs at folks, and I think that that's really an important thing is to follow, you know, just like follow the truth, which is, you know, do you have a solution that customers find valuable? They Obviously, they find it valuable because they pay you money for it, and then they use the heck out of it. Like I've been an Airhouse client for 4 years, I want to say,
That's right.
and right, and like I know, like I'm a like Kevin knows that, and although I'm not ICP for these guys, as an example, like self-published authors that like ship out a few thousand books like a year is like clearly something that Airhouse does really, really well because they just keep paying and paying and paying them, right?
Our ICP is a lot higher now, to be clear.
Oh, I would imagine.
Just for
no, it's not.
Everybody listening.
No, I'm sure. Like, yeah, exactly. It's like sending out thousands of like SKUs a day.
It is. No, yeah. that's totally it. Well, yeah. I know that. So I obviously want to be mindful of your time and all. Mm-hmm. And I also just wanted to kind of wrap up with this episode. I think that, like, obviously everybody should read Peter's book and Founding Sales, and also go to Atrium when you're kind of crossing that level. I think you've done like an amazing job, and we definitely are not at that point that we have enough sales rep to get there. But also I wanted to actually thank you personally for actually mentoring me, honestly, on the sales side of things when I was at Ship and I had no idea what the fuck I was doing. And so just wanted to end that in the episode on this. And so thanks, Pete, for joining us, and for everybody listening, like and subscribe and follow Pete and buy his book and all those good things, and we will see you next time.
Okay,
all right,
cool.
See you, everybody. Bye.
Thanks guys.